Lecture 12, Kautilya and Ashoka, Buddhism and Empire.
Hello, and congratulations. You've now made it to the 12th lecture, and we're back to India, where we started from. So this might be a good time for a quick review. You've heard lots of names and terms. I hope at least some of them are new to you, but I don't want you to feel overwhelmed. We've been looking at two traditions so far, in India and in China. Both of those traditions have answers to life's questions. What's the nature of reality? How do we know what we know? How should society be organized? What's the source of suffering? And how can you find happiness? We've actually seen several different answers to those in each tradition. India and China come at those questions from slightly different perspectives. In India, there's more of a focus on metaphysics. So you remember samsara, which is reincarnation, karma, cosmic justice, dharma is duty, caste duty, or the Buddhist teachings, moksha, which is liberation, freedom from the cycle of existence, atman, this innermost introspective reality, and Brahman is the sort of great absolute reality that's outside of us. All of that has to do with metaphysics. In India, we're dealing with sacred texts that are thought to have been revealed. There are many gods, and there's a keen attention to suffering. Oftentimes in India, people think that family can be an obstacle to spiritual progress. We saw that in the Jains and the Buddhists, though in the Bhagavad Gita, they try to bring those together. We see the caste system everywhere, and the great thinkers tend to transmit their teachings orally, by word of mouth. In China, on the other hand, they tend to concentrate on politics and social interactions. So we heard terms like run, which is benevolence, and li, which means ceremony or ritual. Okay, Taoists do talk about the Tao and about yin and yang that actually do seem to be cosmological, but most of Chinese thinkers tend to be more this-worldly. They care about human nature. The key texts are derived from sages long ago, and in China they tend to look to history for guidance, and the family is thought to be the solution to problems rather than a cause of problems. Ancestor worship is a basic component of religion, and the literature is likely to have started in written form with philosophers who are first writing down their ideas and then transmitting it through that written communication. After Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire in 330 BC, he marched east into India and past the Indus River, in fact, before he returned to Babylon. After his death there in Babylon in 323 BC, when he was 33 years old, Alexander accomplished a lot in a very short lifespan. After his death, those eastern lands fell to his general Seleucus. Seleucus had his hands full with what was happening on the western borders, and Chandragupta Maurya, who was the ruler of a growing kingdom in northeast India, saw an opportunity. So he launched an attack and captured a good chunk of what is today Pakistan and Afghanistan. He signed a treaty with Seleucus in 305 BC, in which they established borders, and he traded the Punjab, this area of what's today Pakistan, for 500 war elephants. Eventually, Chandragupta gained control over northern India, and then his successors took over most of the subcontinent. And this is a time when India is united for the first time in its history. The Mauryan Empire that he founded lasted from 322 to 185 BC, and it was the setting for two of India's most renowned political thinkers, Kautilya and Ashoka. And those are the great minds that we're going to talk about in this lecture. Both of them lived in the same area, and in both cases, they're involved with military conquest and the creation of a universal empire. They're both part of the Mauryan Empire. We'll start with Kautilya, and he's sometimes known as Chanakya. He lives from about 350 to 275 BC. He was a Brahmin. He was an advisor and a prime minister to Chandragupta Maurya, the founder of the dynasty. Kautilya was trained in the Vedas, and perhaps he had some interaction with Zoroastrians. His ideas can be found in a book called The Arthashastra, that's sometimes translated as The Science of Material Gain, or perhaps The Science of Politics. This book was lost for many centuries and then was rediscovered in 1904 in India, written on palm leaves. Now, that version includes some later additions. It probably dates to about 250 AD, so it's quite a bit after Kautilya, but the basic ideas in that seem to go back to this great thinker at the beginning of the Mauryan Empire. The Arthashastra offers detailed, practical advice on economics and politics with discussions of fortifications, right, which are important in this sort of building an empire, and law, also important, taxation, prisons, irrigation, agriculture, manufacturing, trade, coinage, mining, as well as administration, spies, and diplomacy. As you can see, it's a handbook, kind of an encyclopedia of everything you need to know to run an empire in India. About a third of the book is taken up with diplomacy and war, including military tactics. Now, Kautilya's specific recommendations, and let me warn you here, we're going to do lists. Now, remember that lists are just not arbitrary. They're sort of rational, numerical ways of giving a comprehensive view of how things ought to be. So we'll start with a list of the jobs for a hardworking king, what his daily schedule ought to be like. And Kautilya says, let's lay it out in 90-minute increments, so about an hour and a half. At sunrise, he spends the first hour and a half receiving reports, and then 90 minutes of public audiences, and then an hour and a half for breakfast and a bath, and then 90 minutes for meeting with ministers, another 90 minutes for correspondence, then he gets 90 minutes for lunch, and then an hour and a half for inspecting the military, and then meeting with the chief of defense, another period for interviewing secret agents, and then he finally gets an hour and a half for dinner. And then 4.5 hours of sleep. And then he gets up in the middle of the night for a 90-minute period of meditation, and then the next period of consulting with counselors and spies, and then right before dawn, some religious duties and palace affairs, and then he starts all over again. Which just sounds exhausting to me, if anyone could do this day after day. Another list. Kautilya gives us the seven elements of the state. So the king, the ministers, the country, and by that he means geography and population and natural resources, fortification, treasure, army, and allies. And then following that list, he gives detailed explanations of each of those components. The idea is that you want to strengthen those elements in your own kingdom by focusing on them and concentrating, and you want to weaken them in the kingdom of your enemies, oftentimes through spies or through secret agents that you send to make trouble. Kautilya presents the mandala theory of interstate relations. Now, a mandala is a schematic representation of the world, sometimes square, sometimes circular. In this case, it's going to be circular. And Kautilya says, imagine that your kingdom is here in the middle, and then around your kingdom, sort of circling around it, are the territories of your enemies, because you're going to have different interests than they do. You're going to be competing with each other. And then if you draw a circle around the circle of your enemies, they're going to be your enemies' enemies, right, because they're right next to them. And your enemies' enemies are actually your allies. And then there's another circle around that who are going to be your enemies, allies, you need to be careful with them, and so on. It goes through 12 layers, 12 levels of these concentric circles. And he gives advice for dealing with each type of state, depending on where it falls in that schematic representation. Now, another list, I know the lists just keep coming here. He identifies six methods of foreign policy: peace, war, neutrality, preparing for war, seeking protection, and duplicity, where you're pursuing war and peace at the same time with the same state, sort of through different chains of communication. Kautilya's unsentimental political analysis has sometimes been compared with that of Machiavelli. Since Kautilya writes openly of secret agents and assassinations, he analyzes when it might be appropriate to violate treaties, or not appropriate, but certainly useful to violate treaties, or when you might have to kill your own family members or spy on your ministers. But he's not always ruthless. Kautilya also writes a lot about the dharma of a king. Remember that dharma means duty or morality as well. So the king has a particular moral duty. For example, not to covet other men's property or not to covet other men's wives. That's just going to cause problems for the king. Kautilya's ideas about the dharma of a king can be summarized in this quotation. He says, "The happiness of the subjects is the happiness of the king. Their welfare is his. His own pleasure is not his good, but the pleasure of his subjects is his good." Anthony Black, a professor at the University of Dundee, has observed one might compare Kautilya's teaching with the almost exactly contemporary combination of legalism and Confucianism in China, which was another attempt to combine ethics with practical political pragmatism. Strangely enough, Kautilya's employer, Chandragupta Maurya, is said to have ended his 20-year reign by retiring from the throne and becoming a Jain ascetic, and then eventually starving himself to death. You know, remember the way that Mahavira did. But perhaps, and this is just my own idea, but perhaps following all of Kautilya's recommendations about what a king should be doing from hour to hour was just too exhausting to keep going. Our next great thinker is Ashoka. He's the grandson of Chandragupta, and he's the third ruler of the Mauryan Empire. So he reigns from 269 to 232 BC. He was definitely religiously inclined, though not at first. Okay, and I should tell you, there are two ways to spell Ashoka. One is A-S-O-K-A, and the other is A-S-H-O-K-A. But it's always pronounced with an S-H, Ashoka. And he is one of the most famous converts to Buddhism ever. As is typical, there are many legends about Ashoka, most dating from several centuries after his death. It's said that he was the younger son of the emperor, and while serving away from the capital as the governor of a province, he fell in love with Devi, the Buddhist daughter of a merchant, and then he married her, much to the displeasure of his father. Ashoka eventually killed several half-brothers in order to claim the throne. He was brutal. He was a conquering ruler who expanded the borders of the empire. In the eighth year of his reign, he gained a great victory over the state of Kalinga on the southeastern coast. But when he visited the battlefield the next day and saw the ground littered with corpses, he didn't feel ecstatic over his victory. He felt sorrow. He wondered if it was worth it. Perhaps he remembered the Buddhist teachings that he'd encountered while he was a governor, or he had listened to the words of his wife at some point. And he decided to convert to Buddhism. The name Ashoka means without sorrow. He established Buddhist monasteries. He built 84,000 stupas, each with a relic of the Buddha inside. These are sort of memorials to the Buddha. And he put those all over India. And then he sent missionaries abroad, including his own son and daughter, whom he sent to Sri Lanka to take the good news of Buddhism. If you're interested, you can get the full Bollywood treatment of this story, complete with melodramatic acting and elaborate song and dance numbers, in the 2001 movie Ashoka, with the Bollywood superstars Shah Rukh Khan and Kareena Kapoor. Okay. These are Buddhist legends, of course, and they're preserved in Sri Lanka, where Buddhism became very, very popular. But in India, Ashoka was for the most part forgotten, even though he left some remarkable relics of his reign. There are inscriptions on some 18 rocks and 30 pillars that Ashoka set up all over India. Remember that propaganda is one of the things that these universal empires do. These inscriptions were written in a very early script that was related to Sanskrit. The language was deciphered in 1837 by a Western scholar named James Prinsep. And these are the earliest inscriptions in India, certainly the first actual records of Buddhism. And they offer a glimpse of an extraordinary mind. The story of Ashoka's conversion seems to be accurate. According to the Rock Edict number 13, the conquest of Kalinga resulted in 150,000 people taken captive, 100,000 killed in battle, and many times that number in total deaths. Okay, there may be some exaggeration here, but still, a tremendous devastation and slaughter. And immediately thereafter, according to his own record, Ashoka became devoted to the study of Dharma. Now, remember that in Hinduism, it's caste duty. In Buddhism, Dharma means the teachings of the Buddha. Let me give you the quotation. This is so good that I really ought to read it here. So, Ashoka writes this on his inscription. On conquering Kalinga, the beloved of the gods, and he refers to himself in the third person as the beloved of the gods, felt remorse. For when an independent country is conquered, the slaughter, death, and deportation of the people is extremely grievous to the beloved of the gods and weighs heavily on his mind. What is even more deplorable to the beloved of the gods is that those who dwell there, whether Brahmins, ascetics, or those of other sects, or householders who show obedience to their teachers and behave well and devotedly to their friends and acquaintances, colleagues, relatives, slaves, and servants, all of those people suffer violence, murder, and separation from their loved ones. He goes on to say that he now understands that moral conquest is the most important conquest of all, more important than military conquest. One might expect Ashoka at this point to give up his kingdom and then to become a monk. He doesn't do that. Instead, he vows to become a Buddhist ruler. He wants to govern with compassion. He wants to stop military campaigns and instead spread Buddhism throughout the empire. But he does warn rebels that he will punish them, right? He still has to maintain order. He's got that responsibility. But is it really possible to be a Buddhist ruler? I mean, a religion that is founded on kindness, how does that go with what actually has to take place in order to keep an empire going as far as, you know, spies and police and armies and all of that? Isn't there a problem there? I guess you might ask the question, same question. Is Christian monarch an oxymoron? In Buddhism, Ashoka finds a way, even though the Buddha himself had to choose. Do you remember the prophecy when the Buddha was born that he could either become a great ruler, a Chakravartin, right? Somebody, it means a wheel turner in the sense that he launches chariot invasions into other countries. He could either become a Chakravartin or he could become a holy man, the Buddha. And he has to choose one way or the other. He chooses, of course, to go with spiritual progress. And instead of turning the wheels of chariots, of invading armies, he turns the wheel of the law. That's how he described the first sermon where he taught the Four Noble Truths to his old companions. We learn from other inscriptions of Ashoka that he did away with animal sacrifices, he became a vegetarian himself, and he encouraged others to give up meat. Ashoka provided medicine for both people and for animals, that compassion for even non-human beings. He had trees planted along the roads, and he also established rest stops and wells for travelers, you know, that could water both people and the beasts that bore their burdens. He gave up hunting trips and instead toured the empire, interviewing and giving gifts to the aged, to holy men, and that included Hindus and Jains and other non-Buddhists, and instructing the people in Dharma, which for this inscription, he didn't describe as the teachings of the Buddha. He's not trying to convert everybody to his particular religion, but in these inscriptions, he defines Dharma as obedience to parents and teachers, respect for the aged and for holy men, kindness to the poor and the weak, and compassion for all creatures. What's striking about this is the voice that comes through. Again, let me read to you. Ashoka says, "For 2.5 years, I have been an open follower of the Buddha, though at first I did not make much progress. But for more than a year now, I've drawn closer to the Buddhist order," that's the Sangha, remember, the order of monks and nuns, "and I've made much progress." So whereas that earlier stuff about all the wonderful things he does, that sort of fits into the category of propaganda, which is part of what happens in these universal empires. But the part that I just read you, where he said, "I was trying, I didn't make a lot of progress at first," that seems much more personal, and it seems much more sincere in some ways. He says, "I'm not satisfied simply with hard work or carrying out the affairs of the state, for I consider my work to be the welfare of the whole world." He continues, there's no better deed than to work for the welfare of the whole world, and all my efforts are made so that I may clear my debt to all beings." Ashoka's role in Buddhism is similar to that of Constantine in Christianity. They both are imperial sponsors of a new religion. It's said that Ashoka convened the Third Buddhist Council in order to prevent schisms within the Sangha, much as Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea to prevent Christianity from splintering along different doctrinal or theological lines. In any event, without the support of Ashoka and the weight of the Mauryan Empire behind it, it's very unlikely that Buddhism would have become a world religion. Now, you may ask, if Gautilya and Ashoka are so important, why were their works lost? Remember that the Arthashastra was only rediscovered in the early 20th century, and Ashoka wasn't given a lot of prominence in India. In Ashoka's case, part of the problem is that Buddhism virtually died out in India about the 13th century. We'll talk a little more about that in a later lecture. Though, for right now, we'll just note that it did thrive, Buddhism did thrive, in lands where Ashoka's missionaries had traveled. So in Burma, in Sri Lanka, and in Afghanistan. For Gautilya, the political theorist, it's worth noting that India as a unified empire was probably the exception rather than the rule through Indian history. The Mauryan Empire collapsed after 130 years, and then in the 4th century AD, there was another empire called the Gupta Empire, which lasted about 220 years. But other than that, India was just a place of a lot of warring kingdoms until the 16th century, when the Mughal Empire is established. So in that long time period, you've got maybe 350 years in which India is basically united. Okay, 350 years in India over that whole time period versus, say, 400 years in the Han Dynasty alone. And then in China, once China gets established in the Han Dynasty, and that's about the time of Ashoka, it stays a single political entity until the present day, with just a few centuries of civil war in the middle. So in China, the typical situation is a unified, centralized state. In India, it happens, but that's quite unusual in Indian history. So for that reason, perhaps Gautilya and his specific advice, all the lists he gave about what the ruler of a large empire should do, perhaps that wasn't seen as quite as relevant as it could have been otherwise. In India, social order doesn't come from laws or from a strong government. It comes instead from custom, and particularly from the caste system, which gave everyone sort of guidelines for everyday behavior all the time. And then there's a sort of enforcement as well, as people, you know, look after what other people are doing within their caste, make sure that the rules and the regulations are going. So rather than being imposed from a central government, this order in Indian society comes from social interactions among people of the same caste. There's also some other traditions that fit into this. Gautilya mentions the Hindu ideals of the four stages and the three aims. Okay. Indians have long considered that there are four life stages: a student, and then a householder, and then a hermit, and an ascetic right before you die. And each of those times in life have a very distinctive caste to them. Not caste, but a distinctive duties. So when you're a student, you're living a celibate life, you're studying, you're being obedient to a teacher, and then eventually you marry, you go into the householder time of life when you have a family, when you have a profession, when you have children. And then when you're a grandparent, when you can see your son's sons, then it's time to retire, to live a life of simpler life, get a smaller place, and start to practice celibacy, though your spouse may go with you at this point, but you break off marital relations. And then eventually you go into the renunciate, the ascetic at the end, where it's complete renunciation. You give up all possessions and all family and devote yourself completely to spiritual matters. Okay, so there are four stages in life. There are also three aims in life. Those are dharma, right, which is duty or piety, artha, which is prosperity, like the Arthashastra, and kama, which is pleasure. Moksha, liberation, is going to take one beyond ordinary life. So all three of these goals in life have their place, but some are more appropriate at certain times of life. Gautilya, naturally, thinks that artha is the most important of these. He writes the Arthashastra, because artha makes possible dharma and kama. If you want to remember those in an alliterative way, it's piety, prosperity, and pleasure. The acceptance of pleasure as a valid goal, a legitimate ambition in life, at least for people in the householder stage, explains the existence of a text called the Kama Sutra, a text that's often misunderstood in the West. It's more than simply a catalog of sexual practices, sexual positions. It does talk about sex and sexual practices, but it also devotes chapters to courtship and to marriage, to the lives of courtesans, and the characteristics of extramarital affairs, which the author tells us he disapproves of completely, but he's providing this information so that readers can detect other people's indiscretions. You have to wonder about that, but he is writing within a tradition where Dharma is still important in all this. You have to harmonize all three of these aims of life. I want to conclude with an observation and a question. It's amazing that while Ashoka was committed to a particular faith, he nevertheless urged tolerance, freedom of worship, and respect for all sects. He was, in fact, one of the first proponents of religious pluralism in world history. We saw how he gave gifts to holy men and to clergy from other faiths, and he said this in one of his rock edicts, "Whoever praises his own religion due to excessive devotion and condemns others with the thought, 'Let me glorify my own religion,' he only harms his own religion. Therefore, contact between religions is good. One should listen to and respect the doctrines professed by others." And he further adds that any criticisms of religions, because they are different and have different beliefs, but any criticisms should be offered mildly. Ashoka believed that religion in general was good for people, and that identifying the positive aspects of other faith could strengthen one's own religion. And this is some 1900 years before John Locke's Letter Concerning Toleration, written in 1689. Ashoka seemed to have been going along similar lines of thought much, much earlier. Now, in the two millennia since Ashoka, Asian governments have most often not been models of religious freedom and tolerance. But people who say that Asians are incapable of such ideals simply because they're Asian don't know much about history, and they certainly don't know anything about Ashoka. The principle of religious pluralism is at the heart of modern India today. Even though we think of it as a Hindu nation as opposed to Pakistan, which is a Muslim nation, there are still 150 million Muslims within India, about 15% of the population. And the vision of India has always been as a country that's open and accepting and supportive of religion, but also of religious differences, where there's freedom and tolerance and pluralism. Okay, this is why, to this day, even though there are few Buddhists in India, you can see evidence of Ashoka everywhere. The national emblem of India is four seated lions that are each facing outward, which was originally at the top of some of Ashoka's pillars. This emblem, sort of like the U.S. bald eagle national emblem, is on passports, government letterhead, and all currency. There's also a spoked wheel that signifies the Dharma, the Buddhist Dharma in this case, that was part of Ashoka's pillar design. And this appears in the middle of the Indian flag, where it's known as Ashoka's chakra, which is Ashoka's wheel. And then finally, a question. Western philosophy has long been interested in a universal morality, in ethics that can apply to all people at all times. This isn't exactly foreign to India, right? Buddhism says that everyone must eventually follow the path of the Buddha to gain enlightenment, right? There's one path. Yet in Hinduism, there's not one Dharma for everyone. It depends on one's caste or even on one's stage of life. And that's got me thinking. Might there be different standards of proper behavior for different times of life? I mean, maybe there's some basic moral principles. Don't kill, don't lie, don't steal. But in terms of day-to-day behavior, is there a time to concentrate on career and building up wealth, and then another time in life to focus more on family relationships or spiritual matters? Is it reasonable to expect different sorts of behaviors from single people, married couples, parents with children at home, and grandparents? Maybe you've sometimes seen older people who still dress like teenagers, or even worse, there might be an older fellow out for a run without a shirt on and say, you know, that time in your life has probably passed. Maybe there is a different standard for you right now. Now, I don't want to wander too far into the subject of caste. That's going to be an uncomfortable subject. But people are born different. Do individuals with particular talents, social position, or inherited resources have heightened responsibility to society? Does having unusual abilities, say musical abilities or business sense, mean that a person can be held to different standards, at least in some aspects of life? Does having a severe disability, either mentally or physically, justify different standards? Or is there such a thing as universal moral principles that everyone must follow equally all through their lives? I'm not sure, but I'll let you think about this. Until next time.